This is the Peter B. Collins Show from Green 960 San Francisco. Find out more about Peter B. at green960.com.
Live from the left coast, it's the Peter B. Collins Show, infused with dangerous San Francisco values like compassion, justice, and a living wage. Join the conversation toll-free at 1-888-5-PETER-B and be part of Peter B.'s America.
1, 2, 3,
Come on, let's shake it. Go ahead and shake it just like a Polaroid picture. Last time I brought this up, somebody told me they're going to stop selling Polaroid film next month in July. So you'll just have to go digital. Every week at this time, we set aside an hour to talk about election integrity because there is a screaming need for it in this country. We talk about voting machines, about efforts to suppress the vote of certain people, about the efforts of this administration to distract us with phony voter fraud allegations and prosecutions, while the real issue is election fraud. And Brad Friedman is our go-to guy on these issues. He is the proprietor and citizen journalist at bradblog.com. And Brad has been with me almost every week for 3 years now. And today he took a day off, and he's certainly well entitled to it. Stephen Heller joins us in his stead today. Steve Heller is an election integrity activist who put his own butt on the line to blow the whistle on Diebold. Steve, welcome to the show today.
Thanks, Peter. It's my real pleasure to be with you.
Well, I know a little bit about your story from Brad, and honestly, we may have talked once before, but I wanted to give you, give our listeners a sense of what you did and the price that you paid for it. I do understand that the penalty's alleviating a little bit, but give us a sense of the history here of how you learned about some of the misdeeds of the Diebold Company and what you did to blow the whistle about it.
All right, Peter. Well, this happened actually back in 2004, in January of 2004. I was temping as a word processor at the Los Angeles office of the law firm that represents Diebold Election Systems in the state of California. And as part of my job, I saw documents that provided smoking gun irrefutable proof that Diebold had been and was continuing to use illegal, uncertified software in their California voting machines. And I have no doubt they were committing the same or similar crimes in other states, but the documents that I saw were only about California.
Mm-hmm.
And it presented me with a very difficult ethical dilemma. I have a very strong understanding of attorney-client privilege and how vitally important that is to our criminal justice system, to our justice system in general, not just criminal. My father is an attorney. Two of my three brothers are attorneys, and I'd worked at law firms for about 10 years. So I take very, very seriously the attorney-client privilege statutes.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I also take seriously my democracy. And I take very seriously the idea that every vote cast should be counted and counted accurately, and every registered voter who shows up to vote should be allowed to vote. So I had to make a choice. Do I keep my mouth shut and keep quiet about the fact that Diebold, a company that was going to be counting 50 million American votes in the 2004 election, which at that time was about 10 months away,
yeah,
or do I expose this and commit a serious crime of breaking attorney-client privilege, but expose Diebold's crimes against the state of California and the taxpayers and, most importantly, the voters of California? And I decided that as important as attorney-client privilege is, the right of Americans to vote and have their votes counted accurately, outweighs attorney-client privilege in this instance. And so I chose to commit the crime. I stole the documents, and I exposed them via Bev Harris from Black Box Voting and her website, blackboxvoting.org.
Mm-hmm.
And Bev Harris got the documents to the Secretary of State of California and to the press.
And Kevin Shelley was the Democratic Secretary of State at the time. And his record is now mixed because he resigned in disgrace, not over election issues directly, but he was accused of misspending the federal HAVA dollars. And he also got caught up in a scam where he had raised money from a nonprofit that in turn had received a kind of earmark from him when he was a member of the California State Assembly. And that's what brought him down. But before he left office, how did he respond to the documents that you ultimately were able to leak to him?
Well, as I said, the documents that I stole, I stole them in January of 2004. And right at the end of April, I think it was April 30th, 2004, he announced that he was decertifying Diebold touchscreen machines, also called DREs, direct recording electronic machines, mm-hmm. from the state of California. And he called their behavior despicable. And he said, if that's the way they're going to do business, they can't do business in California.
Yeah. And then after he resigned, Bruce McPherson, a Republican, was appointed to that job. And I was very disappointed with his tenure there. Did he pursue these issues at all? Because, as I recall, he recertified Diebold in a rather murky procedure.
Yes, his method of pursuing these issues was to let Diebold run their flawed and illegal and inaccurate voting machines in California once again. And that was a tremendous disappointment to anyone who values clean and fair elections.
So, Steve Heller, what happened to you?
Well, what happened to me was in August of 2004, you see, I didn't know that I was under criminal investigation. I knew that I'd broken the law, but I was kind of foolish. I thought, well, what I exposed is so serious and so important that that would essentially protect me. But no. In August of 2004, actually on Friday the 13th, ironically enough, just after dawn, there was a pounding on my front door and a simultaneous ringing of the doorbell and police officers outside shouting, felony search warrant, demand entry.
Oh, God.
And in fact, it was 10 LAPD cops and one investigator from the district attorney's office.
And was John Walsh or what's that guy, Chris, to catch a predator? Were they there with cameras rolling?
Well, since what I did had nothing to do with having sex with kids, no. The Catch a Predator people weren't there, nor was John Walsh, because my crime was a white-collar crime that wasn't dramatic or violent.
Yeah.
But it was a crime. I don't deny that or shy away from saying that. Anyway, they searched our house. They took my computer, my wife's laptop, our cell phones, various books and papers off my desk, and other things of that nature. And eventually I was charged with three felonies. And long story short, I ended up pleading guilty to one of the three felonies. The other two were dropped. I had to pay $10,000 in restitution to the law firm, and I was sentenced to 3 years probation, and I remain on probation as we speak. Mm-hmm. I'm a real bad boy.
Yeah. And have you've paid off the fine, so that part's behind you?
Yes, I paid that off, and right now my probation is unsupervised, meaning I don't have to report to a probation officer.
And no ankle bracelet?
No, luckily my ankles are free and clear. You know, I'd never been in trouble with the law before, and, you know, I was always one of those good kids. I did what my parents and my teachers and coaches and stuff told me. I got good grades, and I can't say I never did anything illegal, like in college, smoked a little weed or something, but for the most part, I was always a very good boy, and it was a very strange thing for me to be in trouble with the law, and believe me, I have no plans to ever be in trouble with the law again.
And so what would you counsel other individuals who might end up in a similar situation? Are there ways that you can try to limit your exposure? I mean, it looks like you tried by leaking it through Black Box Voting to at least obscure the source. But, you know, I do understand the calculation you made, and you've been very direct, and I appreciate your candor in saying, yeah, I broke the law, and you had to make a Hobson's choice there.
Yeah, it's true, and I did break the law, and I accept responsibility for my crime. And also, I need to try to look at it as objectively as possible. And I had to be punished in some way for breaking attorney-client privilege, because if I'd been allowed to get away with it without any accountability, that could have weakened, at least a little bit, that could have weakened the provision of attorney-client privilege. And we cannot let that happen. Attorney-client privilege is very, very important. Now, in terms of what other whistleblowers might do or might have, what options they might have, first, if a whistleblower is at a law firm, the way I was, and sees documents that are covered under attorney-client privilege, I would be very, very cautious about exposing them, not only because of the risk to the whistleblower, but because attorney-client privilege, again, must be respected. It is a very important thing. So just by way of explanation, my lawyer told me that if I had been working at Diebold and had seen these documents, internal company documents, not attorney-client privilege, but internal company documents, if I'd stolen them and exposed them, she said certainly Diebold would have fired you, but you never would have been charged with a crime, she told me, because what you exposed was very serious and very important. Mm-hmm. What got me in trouble was the fact that I broke attorney-client privilege. So again, I had to be punished. I think misdemeanor charges would have sufficed instead of felonies, but hey, what are you going to do? You know, you do the crime, you better be ready to do the time.
And do you believe that Diebold has paid appropriately for its law breaking?
No, actually, Peter, I don't. The Secretary of State, Kevin Shelley, recommended that the State Attorney General, at that time was Bill Lockyer, go after them with criminal charges, and Bill Lockyer decided, I don't really know why or what basis he made this decision, but he decided not to pursue criminal charges against them, which is strange because in these documents, their lawyers were telling Diebold, you're breaking the law in California, and Diebold said, okay, we're going to keep doing it. You guys, you lawyers, you budget for criminal defense for us in case we get caught. So I don't know why Bill Lockyer decided not to pursue criminal charges against them. But he did recommend that the state join a QI-TAM lawsuit that had been filed previously by Bev Harris and her partner, Jim March, her professional partner, I mean, Jim March. And the state did join that lawsuit. And in November of 2004, Diebold settled out of court. And they paid a fine of $2.6 million, which to Diebold is the equivalent of you or I having to pay a fine of $26. But that was the only punishment they suffered, that and being decertified for a while, which didn't last very long. That was the only punishment they suffered for their years-long and repeated violations of California law and actively lying to the Secretary of State as well as the taxpayers and the voters.
Top of the blog at Brad Blog right now is a story about a whistleblower, and it doesn't have a happy ending. We'll touch on that as we continue. Steve Heller's with us this hour. We're talking about election integrity issues, and he is a true champion of these matters. He put his own life on the line. 888-5 Peter B. You're welcome to join us with a question or comment. And I've got some copies of the uncounted DVD for callers to the program today. 888-573-8372. Thanks for tuning in to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Are you interested in saving thousands of dollars on your medical expenses? You can travel abroad with OneWorldHealthcare.org to a top-class medical center and get quality care for a fraction of the cost. Savings of up to 75% are realistic. OneWorldHealthcare.org.
We continue our Election Protection Hour here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Brad Friedman off today. Steve Heller is in his stead. And, Steve, I understand that you have the exalted title of Velvet Revolution Election Protection Strike Force Member.
Yes, that's true. I'm on the big time now.
You get a badge for that?
I ought to get one. I think I ought to get a badge and a handgun.
Well, now that they're legal, yeah. In all cases.
Yeah.
Well, at the top of the blog at Brad Blog today is a report that Brad posted while he's traveling on the road. And by the way, he was up near Portland and spent some time on the conservative Lars Larson radio show. So for our Portland listeners, you might want to go to Brad Blog and check for the clip. And Lars, if you're listening, we love you. He sent me an email to slam me on a position a few months ago, but happy to have you listening and welcome to the club here. But Brad is reporting that the whistleblower lawsuit against Hart InterCivic, a voting machine company that was based on the whistleblowing of former employee William Singer, has been withdrawn following a decision by the Supreme Court that makes pursuing the case nearly impossible. It's been under seal for about 2 years, and I understand that Brad is going to be on Ring of Fire with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Michael Papantonio this weekend. I believe Papantonio was the attorney in this case. Steve, do you know much more about this?
Well, I know what Brad put up there, and I know that this is a real disappointment because Hart Intercivic has been aggressively lying and breaking the law in every state in which their machines are used, and this lawsuit was the best chance we had of really putting a stop to this and making sure that they obeyed the law who was the person who was on the case, who's the whistleblower?
Whistleblower Singer, yes.
Yes, I'm sorry, William Singer. As he said, this is a quote from him in a statement he made, Hart Intercivic, he doesn't understand why they are, quote, allowed to do business in Texas despite proof that they are dishonest. They have lied about every issue in the lawsuit, such as the audit report issue, which is easily proven from official election backups, lied about me directly on several occasions in several ways. This company, there's no other way to put it. They are liars, and they break the law in the election laws in every state that they exist in. And yet, for some reason, states are not saying, get the hell out of here. We're not going to use you, criminal bastards. And it's something that really puzzles me. I think election officials love these electronic machines because they think it makes their job easier, and if something goes wrong, they can just blame the machines.
Yeah.
It's really a shame.
It is. It is. You can read more about it at bradblog.com. Arlene joins us from Santa Cruz, listening on KRXA. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. I want to congratulate your guest, really, for all that he's done, and also hope that his life is becoming a little more, hopefully, peaceful.
Well, you know, probation does end eventually.
It does.
Right.
Thank you for that, Arlene. I appreciate your good wishes.
Well, the question I have is where does California stand right now with respect to the upcoming presidential election and the Diebold machines?
That's a very good question. First, let me direct you to a really good website called VerifiedVoting.org.
I don't have a computer, I'm sorry.
Oh, she's computer-free.
Oh, okay. Well,
next time you're at the library, it's verifiedvoting.org, Arlene, or ask a friend to loan you a computer.
What is it? Verified?
Voting. .org.
Voting.
Go ahead, Steve.
That website has a map of the nation, and you can click on any state, and it gives you a breakdown, county by county, of what methods of counting votes or voting are being used there. Now, California is in a better way than some states because we have Deborah Bowen as our Secretary of State, and she's been pretty aggressive at getting rid of voting systems that are inaccurate and are based on DREs or touchscreen machines, which are really very inaccurate. We still aren't completely free of them. There's a couple of counties that do use them, but most of the state is on a mixed paper ballot system with some DREs. And the DREs, there's supposed to be one in each precinct or one at each polling location, which is for use for people who are blind or physically disabled. And everybody else uses a paper ballot. And paper ballots, depending on how they're counted and depending on chain of custody issues, which is a big question, but paper ballots are the best way to go. I and many election integrity activists are very much in favor of hand-counted and hand-marked paper ballots.
Right.
Counted on a local precinct level.
Well, I mail in because I'm a senior. I'm 82 years old. I have not quite a complete disability, but enough that I can't always get to the polling places. But I feel that just in general, not just in elections, but because of the computer, we have become very lax in all kinds of businesses because we don't have a paper trail.
Got your point.
I don't even
Arlene,
get my checks back.
Arlene, thank you very much. Do you have a DVD player?
Yes, I do.
All right, I'm going to send you a DVD. Oh, you've already got it.
Yeah,
okay,
already
beautiful.
Got it.
Stand by for more.
This is the Peter B. Collins Show from Green 960 San Francisco. Find out more about Peter B. at green960.com.
live, unscripted, and unrehearsed, of course. It's the unpredictable Peter B. Collins Show, originating from the dangerous liberal enclave, San Francisco. Call in anytime toll-free at 1-888-5-PETER-B and add your voice to Peter B.'s America.
The Peter B. Collins Show, Progressive Politics, and Electric Guitar Riffs. We're talking election integrity, election protection. Steve Heller in for Brad Friedman from bradblog.com today. I got a couple of lines available right now if you want to join us. 888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. Steven Salinas, you're next here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm really concerned about this next election. Because start with the premise that there is no level below which the Republicans will not stoop to win. And if we have Obama as president and a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, and a few more seats in the House, then it's very possible a whole bunch of these clowns could be going to jail. And they don't want that to happen. They will do anything they can to make sure that doesn't happen.
So you think their desperation, both politically and because of their own vulnerability, will lead them to double down, triple down?
Yeah.
What do you think of that, Steve?
Well, I can't predict the future, but I think Steve is very smart to be concerned about the upcoming election and whether or not the person who actually gets the most votes will be the one who goes into the White House. In terms of what might happen if Senator Obama is elected, I hope he does enforce the law and try to bring to justice and accountability the people who have broken the law. I had to pay the price for my crime. I don't understand why other people should be able to get away with their crimes. But
we see, at least if the primary is any indication, that when Dennis Kucinich filed for the recount in New Hampshire, even though that was a surprise loss to Obama, to my knowledge, he didn't play any part in the post-election investigation of what occurred there, Steve.
That's correct, and it would have only cost his campaign $2,000 to force a recount or to pay for a recount for the entire state, and a lot of people, especially in election integrity movement, don't understand why that happened. He claims, or his campaign claims, to be putting in place a team to aggressively go after suspicious election results should they occur, but based on what happened in New Hampshire, I don't know if that's really going to happen or not. I just hope that it's not a repeat of Al Gore and John Kerry, who pretty much just rolled over and didn't bother to dig into the details of very, very suspicious election results.
Yeah. Selena, Steve, anything else?
No, that should do it. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate
Thanks,
your
Steve.
Call. And we go to line three now, and as I click, I learn this is Audra in Oregon. Hello, Audra. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. First-time caller, new listener.
Well, great. Can we send you a DV&D?
Sure.
Okay, well, don't hang up when we're finished. We'll get your mailing address.
That's great, Audrey. You get to see what a handsome guy I am.
That's right. Steve Heller's in Uncounted.
That's true.
What's your question, Audra?
I'm wondering about paper ballots. We have paper ballots here in Oregon, and I was just wondering why people are so afraid of them.
Well, now,
it seems like our state doesn't suspiciously turn red at the last minute.
Okay, but I think the concern is not that they are paper. It's that they're mail-in. And a very interesting exchange occurred back right before the primary in Oregon. Brad was here, and we took a call from someone like you in Oregon. And this person said, I love voting by mail. And Brad said, I'll offer you $1,000 to vote for the other person. I think this was an Obama voter. And Brad offered the person $1,000 to vote for Hillary. And it illustrated the point that while you may feel secure in your home, marking your ballot and mailing it in, there are various types of diversions or transactions that could take place, and the people who count those votes would not necessarily be able to detect any kind of prevarication like that simply from reviewing your mail-in ballot. Steve, what are your concerns?
Well, you know, know, mail-in ballots, they're a source. First of all, like Arlene, who called a little while ago, she said she's 82 and partially disabled. And being able to drop your ballot in the mail is a really sweet convenience, especially for people who have limited physical mobility or other issues like that. But at the same time, how those ballots are created, what pressure might be brought to bear on people belonging to a union, and everybody gets together and says, here's how you vote. Or there's even been instances of women being told by their husbands, you vote this way. I like the idea. It's less convenient, but I like the idea of having to go to the voting booth and mark your ballot by hand. And that would be helped, I think, by doing what a lot of people have called for, which is make federal elections a national holiday so people do have time. They don't have to rush to work or to get their kids to school. They have time to go and do their civic duty and vote. But I definitely understand Audra's feelings. It's real convenient to vote. You sit at home, you go through the material, you make your choices, and then drop it in the box. That's a real convenient thing and a temptation, but I'm wary of it. I am glad, though, that Oregon uses paper ballots. That's heading in the right direction.
And, Audra, we had a situation here in California. Our primary was the first Tuesday in February, and I heard from a number of irate voters who voted by mail. They requested an absentee, which is the way we do mail-in voting here.
We used to do it that way, too.
Yeah. And so a number of people voted for John Edwards. And some people even had just made online contributions to him. And 4 days, that's the way I remember, but less than a week before the election, John Edwards pulled out.
Right.
And so here people had voted early, mailed it in, and then they had a little bit of electoral remorse.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't have any indication that there has been much fraudulent behavior via the mail-in voting process in Oregon. But it certainly is important to be vigilant and to consider what the vulnerabilities are. Steve?
One more issue about that, about mail-in ballots. One thing that I'm strongly in favor of is counting the ballots on election night at the local precinct level, then posting those results precinct by precinct, and then sending the results to a central tabulation area. With mail-in ballots, we never know who's counting them, where they're being counted, and there's no chance for citizen observation to count those ballots. That's a source of great concern to me.
Well, and, you know, one of the reasons that this is not an American election, but in Zimbabwe, where we have this very ugly situation where a runoff was scheduled to be held at the end of this week, and it probably, you know, will fall apart because Tsvangirai, the opponent who actually won in the first round, has pulled out because of fear for the safety of his supporters. But the reason that he knew that he beat Mugabe was that they counted the votes at each polling place and posted them, and independent groups went around and collated that data, and they were able to establish that despite the manipulation of the vote count by the Mugabe government, that, in fact, the challenger won.
That's right, Peter. That's a perfect example of why counting at the precinct level on the night of election after the polls close is a very important part of election integrity.
Audra, anything else you want to ask?
No, that was everything. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you listening. And what town are you in?
Coos Bay.
In Coos Bay. Great. Well, hold on here, and Joshua will get your mailing address, and we'll ship you out a DVD.
Thank you.
All right. Great to have you along with us today. 888-5, Peter B. Joshua, I see somebody on the line, but there's nobody on the screen, so go ahead and update that for me if you would. And Steve Heller, at Bradblog, an interesting item about Clint Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's a true whistleblower about election theft. This is a guy who was hired by a fellow named Feeney, who is now a member of Congress.
Yeah.
And Feeney came to the company where Clint Curtis worked as a programmer and said, yeah, we want some software that will allow us to steal elections, to flip some votes. And Clint Curtis was shocked by this, and he ultimately blew the whistle and has now twice entered the race to challenge Tom Feeney for his congressional seat there in Florida. And this week, Clint Curtis was asked to go to Texas And what occurred there, Steve? What kind of testimony did he offer?
Well, he testified similar to as he did under oath and also with a lie detector test in Florida that showed he was telling the truth in a sworn deposition about what had happened, how he was asked to create this software that could flip an election and it would be undetectable. And he set it up, actually, as a model. He set it up that if you click on a letter on the screen, you can get access to changing the votes. And he designed this program and then realized that they weren't doing it to – he believed that they'd ask him to do it so they could prevent that kind of voting fraud, but he realized they were asking him to do it so they could actually perform that kind of vote fraud or electoral fraud, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very upset about that, and he's, as you said, running against Feeney, and
right.
We hope that he will be victorious in this fall.
Well, I think he actually beat him last time, but we had a bunch of problems with the Democrats in Congress at the House Administration Committee that is supposed to review challenges to congressional elections, and even in the case where Buchanan stole that election with 13,000 or 18,000 missing votes from touchscreen machines, we saw the Democrats who run the House Administration Committee say, never mind.
Yeah, it was very frustrating, and I think that's part of the problem is that a lot of people, Democrats especially, seem almost afraid to challenge election results. They're afraid of being labeled a kook or a conspiracy theorist, but it's not a conspiracy theory. It's true. Elections have been flipped due to errors and also actual fraud from the voting machines and other methods of fraud, and when that happens, our democracy just begins to crumble away, and if we don't stop that, if we don't stand up and demand accountability from our elections, we're not going to have a democracy anymore.
Let's go to Tim in Marina, listening on KRXA. And Tim, first of all, tell us how much smoke is in the sky there.
Quite a bit, Peter.
Yeah.
It looks like you can tell it's a sunny day, but it looks overcast because of the smoke.
Yeah, it's kind of apocalyptic, I call it.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what's on your mind, Tim.
Talk about the mail-in, like the girl in Oregon. She said they liked it, and I my union supports it, and I understand why they do. But I'm concerned about the results of that happening, as you've mentioned before. Another concern I have with it was back when I was in the Army. I read in the Army Times a commentary from a service member. He always mailed his vote-by-mail ballot in via UPS or certified with some sort of accountability. And he was told that his vote afterwards was told his vote didn't count. He didn't get it to them on time. And he had to press it and show them his receipt that it actually was signed for and arrived well ahead of time.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Now, Tim, it's a little noisy there in your truck, but going back to your union, why does the union support mail-in ballots? Do they feel it's easier to get everybody to get on the same page?
It supports our business.
Oh, you're in the Postal Workers Union.
Yes.
I didn't get that right off the bat. All right, Tim, anything else you want to tell us?
That's it. I kind of like the idea of just doing the paper ballots. If anybody go in, I know I go in.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good to hear from you today. And that does explain.
Yeah, that was funny.
Who he works for. All right, we're going to take a break and return with Steve Heller. You got a comment or a question, bring it on now. Toll free, 888-5-PETER-B, 888-573-8372. It's the Peter B. Collins Show.
This is the Peter B. Collins Show from Green 960 San Francisco. Find out more about Peter B. at green960.com.
We're in the home stretch here on the Peter B. Collins Show, 10 minutes before the hour. Stephen Heller sitting in for Brad Friedman today. Brad, of course, the proprietor of bradblog.com. He's on the road on the Oregon coast. If you see him, buy him a drink, will you?
Traveling
And Steve Heller, I wanted to ask for your thoughts on a couple of news items and issues that have surfaced recently. In the past week or so, Barack Obama finally gave an answer and opted out of the presidential campaign finance system. It would have limited him to $84 million, and he raised far more than that in the primary and expects to exceed that in the fall. And he makes the case that he is actually fulfilling the spirit of campaign finance reform because he has $1.5 million donors. Average contribution is under $200. Does that wash with you?
Yes, it does, because the thing is, campaign money isn't necessarily in and of itself a corrupting influence. What matters, whether or not it's corrupting influence, is the source and the amount of money. When individual citizens give, you know, $50, $100, $20, $5, whatever it is, that's not buying them some sort of major role in writing legislation. But when corporations and lobbying groups give millions of dollars to campaigns, cumulatively millions of dollars, that buys them a seat at the table. And we see examples of that with a lot of legislation, like, for instance, the HAVA legislation. That legislation was pretty much written completely by the voting machine companies, and they wrote it to ensure that touchscreen machines and their equipment would be what's used. So that's a perfect example of the source of money being an indication of whether or not it's having a corrupting influence. I'm proud that Obama is financing his campaign largely completely without the 527s. He said he won't take their money, and he's financing it through small donations of American citizens. That's the way it should be done. I wish Senator McCain would do the same.
Yeah. Well, I generally agree with you on that. I am not really offended, and my hope is that if he wins, that he'll help restructure the whole system from what he's learned in this long, long campaign that we've been enduring.
I hope so, too. And it also should be pointed out that Senator McCain, you know, I think he's a good man, but he pulled a fast one. He said he's going to take public financing, secured a loan of $4 million based on the promise of public financing, and then went without public financing. That's of questionable legality.
Yeah. Steve, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is I am a big supporter of Dennis Kucinich and his 35 articles of impeachment that were introduced a couple of weeks ago.
You bet.
And I deplore the media blackout and the way the Democratic Party has, by and large, ignored his efforts. There are a few exceptions, Wexler and some California members, I believe Barbara Lee and Maxine Waters and Lynn Woolsey, have co-signed onto the articles of impeachment. But let's focus on the election integrity elements of the impeachment articles. I know that you and Brad Friedman helped the Kucinich team draft these, and I'm really pleased that he included them. There were some 60 potential articles of impeachment, and he pared it down to 35 in the initial presentation. He may, in fact, introduce more. But tell me a little bit about your thoughts about what this process could mean if the Democrats would honor the Constitution and allow the process just to take its own course.
What it could mean is that the president might well be held accountable for very, very serious crimes that he has committed, or that I believe he has committed. Technically, it's still alleged. But by his own admission, he has spied on Americans without a warrant. Now, come on, America, whether you're Republican or Democrat, right or left, whatever, you don't want your president spying on Americans without a warrant, do you? And a president that does such a thing of any party, I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican or Green or Libertarian or whatever, that president needs to go. Same thing with torturing prisoners. I don't care how dangerous our enemies might be. Torturing our prisoners is not going to help us protect ourselves from future attacks, and it's not going to help us protect our soldiers who are at war and who are at risk of being taken prisoner themselves. We need to follow the Geneva Conventions, and a president who willfully and arrogantly decides, no, we don't need to follow them, and we will torture prisoners, that president must be impeached for the sake of our Constitution and for the sake of our collective national soul.
And Steve, the book Witness to a Crime by Richard Hayes Phillips provides ample evidence that John Kerry won Ohio by as much as 180,000 votes, not the losing side that came in the official tabulation of about 119,000.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I was lucky enough to have a copy of Richard Hayes Phillips' book, and he has a DVD that comes with a book that provides you with photographic evidence of things like ballots that were altered, John Kerry's name sort of whited out and George Bush's name filled in. And
Also, he found pre-punched ballots.
That's right. I was just going to say pre-printed or pre-punched ballots that were given out. So there was a lot of dirty crimes that went on in 2004, and the Bush administration is responsible for a lot of them. And again, these are issues that it's not a partisan thing. Any president that engages in this kind of horrific abuse of power, spying without a warrant, torturing prisoners, rigging elections, that president must be impeached. And I know it's thought of as a partisan thing, but it isn't. I don't know if anyone will believe me, but had Al Gore not only been elected, if he'd actually been inaugurated, if he had engaged in these kind of activities, I would be screaming just as loudly, maybe a little more loudly, for his impeachment. You bet.
And Richard Hayes Phillips will be coming to California, I think it's the week after next, mid-July, and we're working to get him on the program. I know he's got an appearance in Santa Cruz and several in the San Francisco Bay Area, so stay tuned, and we'll keep you updated as that information becomes available. Andy in New York, thanks for calling the Peter B. Collins Show. Say hello to Steve Heller.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Hi, Andy. I'm fine, thank you.
And hi, Peter.
Hello.
Hey, Steve, thank you very much for going the extra mile and putting your whole life on the line, essentially, for doing what you did.
You're welcome.
That's great. I just wanted to say, you know, the problem is, in the mainstream media, there's a total blackout on any problems with the elections. You know, because the 2000 election was able to happen with really not anybody getting as upset as they should have gotten, and in 2004, with Kerry not putting up a fight, there is no problem, you know, with the mainstream. And I belong to Democracy for America. I'm here in New Jersey. I go to monthly meetings, and they shout me down, basically, when I tell them we have to focus on these electronic machines because it's all electronic here in New Jersey. These machines have to go, and these people are supposed to be well-informed, and they tell me there is no problem, that Bush did win both elections. And these are supposedly progressive. I'm going, Mark Crispin Miller, read the book. I mean, look at what happened. The University of Chicago studies, Media Consortium, but it doesn't penetrate, even with progressives here.
All right. What's your comment, Steve?
Well, I think the problem is that Americans are truly afraid to believe that our electoral system is broken and that we've got a person in the White House now near the end of his second term who was not elected. I think that's a very frightening thought. And unless you've seen it with your own eyes the way I did at the lawyer's office or the way I did when I went to Columbus, Ohio for the 2004 election and saw with my own eyes Jim Crow strutting up and down the streets of inner city Columbus, unless you've actually seen it, Americans want to believe that everything is ultimately okay. We want to, as you say, stay asleep and not confront the reality that our democracy has already been taken from us and we need to take it back. That's a frightening thing, and people are afraid.
Andy, thanks for your call. Steve Heller, thanks for a great hour. Really a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it was my pleasure, Peter. I enjoy hearing your dulcet tones in my ear for an hour, and I hope to join you again sometime in the near future.
That's a deal. Thank you again, Steve.
Okay.
And enjoy yourselves. We'll be back at you very soon here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Again. Happy trails to you.
This is the Peter B. Collins Show from Green 960 San Francisco. Find out more about Peter B. at green960.com.